Welcome to Fit and Chips Chats. This is a podcast for women over 40 who are looking for sane and frank advice about their health and wellness, especially through menopause. I'm Amanda Thebe, the original resilient bitch and menopause guru. In my work as a personal trainer and nutrition coach, and through my own personal experience, it became obvious to me information about menopause and this curious phase of our life was so ridiculously hard to find. And that's why I started this podcast. Join me every week as I speak to health and wellness experts on hot topics that directly impact you. I've made it my mission to help you by exploding a few myths, presenting you with the facts, and hoping to inspire you to be a healthy, strong person just like me. If you like this show, please subscribe and leave a review. Then go and tell your friends, and then go and tell your husband, and then tell the neighbor, and then don't forget to visit me at fitandchips.com. And now let's get started on today's show. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Fit and Chips Chats. I have on my friend, Dr. Brooke Kalanick. How are you, Brooke? Good to have you on the show.
I'm good. Thank you.
Let me just tell everyone a little bit about you if they don't already know you. I met Dr. Brooke at the Girls Gone Strong Fitness Summit. I think it was, that might be 4 years ago now. And I really liked the way that she spoke about women's health and women's health issues in such a great, practical terms, easy to understand information. And she's now written a whole ton of books, and she's got a new book out that's due to be launched on the 4th of June called Hangry, which she's co-authored with Sarah Fragoso. Dr. Brooke is a licensed naturopath and functional medicine doctor. Dr. Brooke attended Seattle's Washington Bastia University, where she earned a doctorate in naturopathic medicine and a master's in acupuncture and Chinese herbal medicine. Her postdoctoral training in women's health and functional endocrinology, as well as her personal battle with PCOS. And I know we say them differently. I think I say PCOS, you say PCOS, but led her to specialize in female hormonal issues, including menopause, hypothyroidism, and including Hashimoto's, autoimmunity, and endometriosis, and of course, PCOS. She helps women reset their hormones, their heads, and their habits so they can finally feel at home in their bodies. She's also the co-host of the Sarah and Dr. Brooke Show and the co-author, as I've said, of her brand new book, Hangry, Balance Your Hormones and Rediscover Your Joy in 5 Simple Steps. And like I said, that's due out on the 4th of June. We'll come back to that at the end of the show, but without much to ado, hello, Brooke, and welcome back.
Hello.
And I'm actually saying welcome back because we've already done this podcast before, didn't we? It was awesome.
It was great. And the world will never know, but it was great for us.
Yeah, the world will never know because we did this amazing podcast. I wrote 20 pages of notes, but I forgot to press record. And I was devastated. It's the first time I've ever done it. And I was like, I'm such an idiot. But she's a good sport and she's back to humor me again. And I've actually got it recording right now. I can see.
I can see it too.
Good. Okay, so thank you for coming on the show. I know you're a huge advocate for women's health, and I love the work that you do. Can we start talking about perimenopause? I'd love to just get in there because that's the bulk of my listeners on this show. In your opinion, what's the best way to manage perimenopausal symptoms when a woman doesn't feel like it's ready to even consider like hormonal therapy, if that's the route she's going to go down? Because it's a big open-ended question, and I know you've got a big answer for me.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, whether or not a woman decides to use synthetic or bioidentical hormones, of course, there's so many factors that go into that, right? Like, what's the goal? What's our risk factor? How much we're suffering with our symptoms? So that could probably be a podcast, you know, in and of itself. But if you either haven't made that decision yet, or you don't feel maybe it's like even that time, but you're starting to notice hormone fluctuations, this is an area where natural medicine really shines. We've got a lot to offer. So whether, you know, there's a lot to offer in terms of if you are taking hormones, you know, help to make sure those are safer and your doses are optimized. But if you're just sort of looking before that consideration, or if that's not something that's going to work for you, there's a lot of things you can do to help with symptom management and help your just hormone landscape be a little bit less bonkers and less symptomatic. So what happens, you know, menopause, of course, is when we haven't had a period for 12 months. before that, we have the perimenopausal time, and women can start seeing hormone decline as early, you know, as their early 30s. It, of course, becomes more pronounced as we start to go through what's, you know, known as the perimenopausal transition, which can last, you know, for years for some women. And when it's part of it is you are having, so kind of to understand what's going on with your hormones. When it comes, you know, we think of menopause and perimenopause, and we immediately go to estrogen and progesterone, right? Like those are, that's what this is about. And yeah. What's happening with those hormones is that they are sort of sputtering and eventually going to stop. So you get a lot of erratic hormones, especially estrogen. Progesterone is sort of on the decline as we stop ovulating as regularly or maybe as robustly as we were. So that one starts to go down. Estrogen's going to be up and down for a while. And that one is the one that causes us the most symptoms, that causes the hot flashes and what can kind of feel like, you know, weeks and weeks of PMS type symptoms. So yeah.
I just want to sort of just say that. And I know that some women who don't feel like they're in perimenopause are really struggling around the PMS time. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was for me. But in fact, I now know it was the start of perimenopause. And so that's sort of the time that you're sort of like this stuff really helps, right? Because you know something's different, but you're not, it's not like a tangible, oh yeah, I've entered perimenopause now. Something's changing and I don't know what it is, right?
Yeah, and I think as women, we're so good at ignoring it, right? It's like, well, that was a bad period, but I'll hope for better the next time, you know? And then we look back and we're like, okay, it's been 6 months of this. I probably need to get in to see someone or, you know, do some research, figure this out. But oh my gosh, my kid has a thing or I've got a promotion or whatever. And we're so good at putting ourselves
ignoring
on the burner. Of course, leads us to more hormone issues because, you know, we all of those hormones affect each other. And the longer they're out of balance, you know, the more out of balance we can become. So I'll talk a little bit about some specific estrogen and progesterone, you know, treatments for those fluctuations. But something to always remember is, again, we hear perimenopause or we start seeing those symptoms around our cycle, or we hear menopause and we jump right to thinking, oh, this is an estrogen, progesterone problem. Testosterone's also going to go up during perimenopause and down eventually. But we think of it as those sex hormones. And this is a time when your adrenal health, so how well your, how robust and coordinated your stress response is, how well you can adapt to stress, is going to be really profound in how much symptoms you have. And in part of that is because as your ovarian hormone production goes down, your adrenals do some stuff to try to support you. So it can make some progesterone, it can upregulate DHEA, which can then get converted to peripherally to estrogen and testosterone. So your body's really trying to level the ship. So one of the biggest things a woman can do going through perimenopause is support her stress response. So that is both in terms of how much is on your plate, how much can you let go of, what are your stress management skills? Like, are you meditating? Do you have a mantra? Do you have something, a tool that works for you to kind of handle the stress of everyday life? Are you taking on too much? How's your blood sugar? How is inflammation in your life? How's your stress? Are you over-exercising? Are you giving enough time to recovery, to have recovery? All of those things. And then in addition, of course, we can support with nutrients like a good suite of B vitamins and possibly those, you know, adrenal adaptogens, those herbs that sort of help re-coordinate the brain and the adrenals so that we have a more even stress response. So we want to make sure we're addressing the adrenal health. You want to make sure you're addressing blood sugar. You want to make sure you're addressing inflammation. And inflammation can come from a host of things. It can come from lack of sleep. It can come from how we're training, having an unhealthy gut, or working on, you know, not eating foods that maybe don't work for us that cause inflammation. They're sort of the common culprits, like gluten and dairy are often at the top of that list, but it could be anything more unique for us. And then, of course, there's lots of great treatments to help kind of temper the estrogen and progesterone. So during that time, if you're still cycling, Vitex can be a great herb to help boost the progesterone. I will often give this just day 15 or, you know, right after ovulation until the next period. Sometimes it can be used a little bit more continuously going through perimenopause. It's kind of one of those things. Try it and see how it works. Great herbs for just leveling estrogen are phytoestrogen herbs like black cohosh. So you can take usually around 100 milligrams of that per day. Those two things alone are kind of a good those are kind of the bread and butter of starting that hormone transition. There's also herbs like shatavari, and there's some other good like female hormone tonic kind of herbs. But those phytoestrogen herbs help kind of give your system a little bit more support so you have less symptoms. If you're really dealing a lot with hot flashes in particular, the black cohosh might be enough. There's other herbs like rhubarb. There's a product from a company called Metagenics called Estrovera, and it's 4 milligrams of rhubarb extract, and 9 times out of 10, one or two of those a day really, really helps with the hot flashes. And that one's considered safe even if you have, you know, any estrogen related issues in
like
your history.
Or anything, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then what about, because a lot of these things that can be food derivatives as well. I mean, what about like the phytoestrogens we can get from some of our food sources? Is that something that you push women to try and look for?
Yeah. So when you're going through initially just sort of like a transition, right, when things are just starting to change, food and herbal medicine done like as a tea, this is going to be the time when things are just starting to get out of balance, or something like seed cycling where you use pumpkin and flax, you know, you rotate through different seeds that are considered estrogenic versus supporting progesterone. During when things are just kind of starting to get out of balance, this is a good time to, yeah, you can boost. First, soy for some people is okay. It doesn't bother their digestion. I mean, soy in our country, unfortunately, is like highly genetically modified, so it tends to be a real food sensitivity. But things like flax, again, pumpkin seeds, those things can be used, again, more effectively when you're just starting this transition. Or again, like maybe you can find a menopause support tea, right, that has a concoction of those herbs. If you're going to use food as medicine or herbs as medicine, again, that like beginning fluctuation is the time they're going to work the best. If you're ever going to use a tea, whether that's like a sleepy time tea or a menopause support tea, where women often go wrong is they, you know, they will do like one tea bag, and you really need like 4 to 6. If you're going to like juice that and try to like really get some of those benefits, you're going to want to just make it really strong. And then as women have more symptoms, then a little bit higher dose of those things, like in a capsule or a tincture, is probably going to be, you know, more effective at that point.
Right, yeah, because you're just not going to get enough out of your watery tea at all.
Yeah, make those teas strong. I see like most women are like, there's barely anything in that. And it's nice and safe, but it's often not very effective.
Yeah, and I think as well, like you were talking about the food things, I know sometimes a lot of women are looking for the answers in like pill form and stuff, and they're looking for that, you know, I don't feel well, so I need to look at like maybe taking a supplement or something. And a lot of the times, like even just starting at their food choices is just a really good thing. I know that you're a big proponent of this as well, like just the fact that get rid of some of that processed crap that's in your diet. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to eliminate some of that refined added sugar. It's in everything and people just don't realize, right? And if you're talking about supporting this whole adrenal system and our stress levels, and women are so stuffed in the face, it's full of rubbish. It's not going to, you have to support yourself like body, mind and soul, don't you, during this time?
Yeah. And, you know, that's why, again, I mentioned at the beginning that we think about estrogen and progesterone, but we have to go back to the blood sugar, which is not going to do well if you're eating a lot of processed food. Inflammation's not going to do well if you're eating a lot of, you know, food that doesn't work for you in one way or another. So, yeah, I really think the cornerstone of this transition or any hormonal issue has to be our stress and our food. So at the base level, you know, one of the things that's really going to help with estrogen metabolism is going to be lots of veggies. So we want those good cruciferous veggies, broccoli sprouts are one of our, like, I hate superfoods. I even hate that term. But if there was a superfood, I would probably say it was broccoli sprouts. They have a ton of a component called sulforaphane, which really helps with our own estrogen metabolism. What can happen, of course, is if our gut's unhealthy, we have, and our liver's not detoxing and metabolizing those hormones quite right, we can get a lot of fallout with the more painful tender breasts and the water retention and the heavier bleeding. And of course, all that gets worse going through this perimenopausal time because the progesterone is falling. So vegetables, fiber, those brassica veggies, especially things like broccoli sprouts, are going to be great things to make sure that you're eating plenty of to help, you know, balance this whole system. It's also going to balance your blood sugar, which is going to impact those hormones too. And then making sure you're having enough protein. So what many women notice as they start to lose estrogen and progesterone, weight loss becomes like a whole different thing. And what used to work didn't work as much. So we have to rethink, like, do I need more protein, perhaps less carbohydrate? Do I need a little bit more healthy fat? And just kind of rethink what may have worked for you. And I usually recommend all women get at least 100 grams of protein a day. And just going through this transition as your hormones change, we want to cling so tightly, especially when we start to gain weight. One of the first things when a woman starts to gain weight, and I've done this too, the first thing you think is like, remember that time that I lost so much weight? I'm going to go do that. And we have to remember that we're in just a whole different hormone landscape than we were when we were, say, 26. And weight loss, you know, something that worked then may fail miserably during this time. So we really want to honor kind of those basics and tune into how things are now.
Yeah, and especially if they're going through some of these adrenal sort of challenges as well, like stressing the body out with extreme dieting is probably the last thing your body needs, right? Because it's already saying, I need help. I don't need you to starve me. I need you to nourish me and make me feel better, right?
Yep, exactly.
And so talking about different hormonal things that women can face is in my Menopausing So Hard group, there's often talk of different conditions that I know nothing about. And this is why I have you on the show as well. Just I had a Hashimoto sufferer in the group, and she wanted to know a little bit about diet, what sort of things she should increase and what sort of things she should probably avoid. And if you could maybe explain what Hashimoto's is as well, so that it sort of clears up that confusion.
Yeah, so Hashimoto's is the most common cause of low thyroid issues in the Western world. So Hashimoto's is an attack on the thyroid gland, either to an enzyme or to a protein component. So those are in the thyroid gland, and an autoimmune attack is simply when your body has flagged something that belongs to you. It's been flagged like it's a bacteria or a virus or some sort of foreign invader. So it's literally a self-attack. And so in the case of Hashimoto's, you're attacking the thyroid gland, one of those two components. And so some women know they have Hashimoto's, some don't. If you have not been screened for Hashimoto's, I would recommend that you do. It's TPO and TAA antibodies. You do want to get them both. Often the TPO is checked and the other one is not. So having Hashimoto's means you have an autoimmune disease. In this case, the autoimmune disease is attacking the thyroid. And so you may also have low thyroid from that. Most women do, not all. Some women will notice that they've been screened and they've got positive Hashimoto's antibodies, but at this point, their thyroid is still doing okay. So you could be in one of those two camps, and the problems are sort of different. So one issue, we may have a hypothyroid situation, and so you're not making enough active free thyroid hormone. And that could be because you have Hashimoto's or for some other reason. So we may need to address, you know, a variety of things that can go wrong in that whole cascade. If you have Hashimoto's and hypothyroidism, you want to make sure your thyroid levels are optimal, but you also want to address this immune activation. So whether it's Hashimoto's or anything else, we want to make sure we're not eating anything that's causing more inflammation. So the ones that are the most associated with autoimmunity tend to be gluten and dairy. I would throw soy in there just because it's such a common issue for so many people, probably largely because of the way it's been genetically changed. But truthfully, anything that causes you inflammation. So if you've got an unhealthy gut, you know, and it's letting proteins in that aren't completely digested or shouldn't be crossing into your system, then you definitely can end up with sensitivities to all kinds of foods. So we, you know, call this gut intestinal hyperpermeability or leaky gut. And this is basically an unhealthy bacterial environment, unhealthy intestinal cells, and too much stuff is getting in, agitating your immune system. And that's a problem for all of us. This is, of course, even a bigger problem if you have autoimmunity. So I definitely recommend making sure you've got lots of like good, healthy gut bacteria, but you can be sensitive to anything. So if you're somebody who eats the same thing every day, like you've had the same protein shake every day for the last 5 years, you might want to consider rotating that out. If you're someone who's eating chicken every single day, you might want to consider mixing up those proteins. You can get tested for food sensitivities. I recommend only testing through a lab called Cyrex. A lot of food testing is really inaccurate, so it tends to not give us too much information. You can also do like some sort of elimination diet, like a Whole 30 or a paleo challenge, that tends to take out the most like egregious offenders. The trouble with doing it on your own, of course, is when you want to put those back in, if you haven't healed your gut during that time using like something that I laid this out in our book, Our Gut Healing Protocol. If you haven't done something like that, when you go to put foods back in, quite often you're going to react to them again. And therefore the goal of you learning what you can and can't eat isn't, you know, really achieved, right? So I do recommend if you're going to bother putting yourself on an elimination diet, heal your gut while you're doing it, and then be systematic about putting the things back in, right? Take the time to challenge things back in one at a time, wait a couple days so that, you know, so many people have done like a serial number of Whole30s, right? They just keep going back to that and never really learning anything because that first day you get to eat whatever you were missing. We tend to just like go all in. So being systematic about reintroducing things can help you know if there's, you know, more unique things. But I do find that if you don't heal your gut during that time, most of the things are going to come back and you're going to be sensitive to them. And that's not, in my opinion, the goal is to always have you be able to have the biggest, you know, variety of foods. In addition to that, like kind of another tier up for Hashimoto's and autoimmunity is what's called the autoimmune protocol. And that tends to be a paleo diet with the addition of taking out eggs, nightshades, nuts, and seeds. So it's a little more, restrictive, I guess, but those are some of the other common culprits because of lectins and things like that in those plants that can be aggravating for autoimmunity. Again, if you work to kind of heal your gut, hopefully you don't have to be off all of those foods forever. When it comes to foods that should be avoided just by having low thyroid, there is what is still kind of out there as avoiding brassica veggies and soy, things that are called goitrogens. And this isn't inaccurate, but it's sort of impractical. Most of us are not going to eat nearly enough brassica veggies in one day to have a hindering effect on our thyroid. What these goitrogens do is they sort of block the uptake of iodine into your thyroid gland, so you don't get as much of the raw materials to make the thyroid hormone. A light cooking, light saute, light steam of these vegetables sort of negates this anyway. And again, I don't find, other than the possible exception of someone was, you know, let's say having a soy milk latte in the morning and then a soy protein shake and then tofu the rest of the day, theoretically, could they get enough soy to hinder their thyroid? Possibly. Yeah. But I don't think it's a real concern when it comes to the thyroid.
And also it gets to the point where people get afraid to eat, right? They get to the point where they're like, well, I can't eat that and I can't eat that. And it just becomes a non-practical way of living. I remember you speaking about this before, and you were saying about taking pre-op probiotics for the gut as well. Mm-hmm. And then maybe some supplements to support somebody going through this, because there is a synthetic drug that will often be prescribed to women. I can't pronounce it. Levothyroxine, is that right?
Levothyroxine is Synthroid. That's the most common thyroid prescription.
Right. And I know one of the questions one of the listeners had was that, is there any supplements that they could take, not particularly to replace it, but even just to support the synthetic thyroid drug that they're taking?
So with thyroid support, so like, and I found this a challenge when I was working on our book, because of course in our book there's different hormone issues that we talk about, and there's a pretty clear protocol for what to do, what you can take for low cortisol and what you can take for insulin resistance. And thyroid is so much more complicated because it really depends where in the thyroid cascade you're having a breakdown. That the nutrient support or the treatment's going to be very different. So real quick kind of walk through the thyroid physiology. Is it's starting at the brain in the pituitary and the hypothalamus. They're going to signal the thyroid with the hormone called TSH to make thyroid hormone. Your thyroid gland is going to mostly make T4. Then that needs to get converted into active T3. And then that T3 needs to have the right amount of binding proteins that it's going to get carted around on. If there's too much, you're not going to have enough free hormone to bind a cell receptor and then have an effect. So you could be having thyroid issues at any point on that cascade. So if you don't remember anything else I said, the things that impact that cascade in multiple ways are high cortisol and inflammation. So again, if you can't get on top of those things, you know
they
your
keep
thyroid.
Coming back, don't they, darling? They're not going away.
They are not. I always call inflammation the great hormone mess maker, because it doesn't matter which hormone we're talking about, it's messing everybody up. So when in doubt, if you're overwhelmed by anything that I said, what can you do to lower inflammation? Get more rest, watch your stress, make sure you have a healthy gut, don't overtrain, and make sure that you're managing your stress. So, and not eating foods that you know give you inflammation.
Yeah.
So back to the thyroid and the Synthroid question. So what Synthroid is synthetic T4. Now there's a lot of thyroid medications. Synthroid is, or levothyroxine is certainly the most common. So the one thing we know we need at the level of the thyroid to kind of even participate in that reaction is we need plenty of selenium. So 200 micrograms of selenium is a good support for all of us for our thyroid. Selenium, so that can be helpful. Excuse me, as we were talking off air.
Take a drink of water. She's sick today, Anya Brooke.
I've been sick forever. I finally just gave up. I'm just like, oh, just, I'm going to go on with life with a scratchy throat.
But you're allowed to take a drink of water. I approve.
So
200 mg of selenium.
Micrograms of selenium. Yeah. If you're taking Synthroid, so you're taking T4, or if it's just your own T4 that you're making, we want to make sure again that that gets converted into that active hormone, which is T3. So that reaction is going to be slowed down by cortisol and inflammation, so deal with those. That reaction is benefited from some zinc, so make sure you've got probably 25-30 milligrams of zinc in your world, in whether that's your multi or you take some extra zinc. So that is one way to make sure that you're getting either from your own T4 or from your medication T4 into T3. The next thing that has to happen is you want to make sure that, again, you don't have too much stress or inflammation, because those are going to steal that T3 down a pathway called reverse T3. Once we do that, it's inactive. So again, stress and inflammation there. You can get some more conversion of the T4 into T3 in a healthy gut. So again, back to making sure we have, you know, a nice healthy gut. And then next up is those free hormones. So if you have estrogen dominance, whether you are taking a birth control pill, you're taking hormone replacement, or you don't have healthy estrogen metabolism in your liver and your gut, then you can end up with estrogen dominance. And that's going to drive down your free levels of that active T3. So that's another way we can support that. So healthy gut there. Sometimes again, Brussels sprouts too, but those broccoli sprouts, there's a compound in all those brassica veggies called indole-3-carbinol. So you can take that in a supplement, or you can take its derivative called DIM in a supplement. Yeah. And that can help
and DIMs can help support with the estrogen, right?
Yep. So that helps again with estrogen metabolism. Some women will notice that really helps. DIM is going to help all those estrogen dominant symptoms. So the heavier bleeding, the painful breasts, the water retention, things like that. Now, if you take DIM and your hot flashes get worse, then you want to stop, because we know that you're getting that estrogen that you had before. Once we metabolize it better with the DIM, it's now too low.
It's
so
too
definitely worth trying.
And then just a quick thing on the Brussels sprouts. I mean, this is a really great time to move into the spare bedroom. Like if you're going to be eating sprouts and cauliflowers, your husband or your partner aren't going to want to know you for a while. So I'm telling you.
Yeah, sometimes those can be tough on the digestive system. So you can always do other veggies. You want the fiber, but that can come from other veggies. But you could take a supplement of some of those things too, if that's.
But it's just the whole idea of like improving that gut microbiome as well. Just like getting all of that decent fiber, and we lack so much fiber in this country. It's insane, right? So we do need to sort of be focusing on that as well. And so okay, that's great. So that's Hashimoto's. Was there something else you were going to add onto that, Brooke?
I just think it's so funny. I literally, right before you and I got on this call, I just recorded a thyroid physiology webinar, which will be one of the bonuses for the book. So if you pre-order our book, you can get that webinar for free. And that is kind of walks you through that whole cascade and, you know, in more detail about what you need to look at.
And it's very complicated, right? But I think that as soon as you know it's something you're struggling with and you have like a base understanding of what's happening, then the control and the things that you can do to support yourself just completely change, because you're not just stabbing in the dark. You're actually actively trying to improve, you know, your symptomatic side of things. And so, yep. So if you've got Hashimoto's and it's something you're struggling with, and after listening to this, head over to that webinar. I think that would be so great.
Yeah. And just to address the Hashimoto's in particular. So that was all like, what do you do with the levothyroxine and what do you do in the thyroid cascade? If you're thinking of like, how do I just best support this immune system that's gone off the rails? Then again, healthy gut, using turmeric, having your vitamin D levels healthy, supporting glutathione, which is one of our main antioxidants, either by taking N-acetylcysteine or taking liposomal glutathione. Those are really important things you can do to kind of quiet the Hashimoto's piece of it.
Right, great. What? How much vitamin D? Like 4,000?
So vitamin D, you got to know your level. So, you know, Amanda, you might need 4,000. I might need 8. So you want to get a test called the 25-hydroxy vitamin D test. And I like levels between 50 and 80. That's what I look for in my practice. And so if your level is 20, you might need to supplement with 8,000 IUs for a couple of months to get it up. But then you might only need 2 to 4 to keep it there. So I really like to dose that one, you know, based on lab testing. And I think because vitamin D is, you know, so hot right now, everyone's talking about it, everyone's taking it. A lot of times patients will come in and their vitamin D is like well over 100. It can be toxic. It's usually not toxic till it's much higher. But the truth is you just don't need it up that high. And D in general, you want to be taking with vitamin K. I tend to use a product from a company called Designs for Health. They have a liquid vitamin D called Emulsi D Synergy, and it's got the D and the K. Sometimes I will use D alone initially if it's really low to get it up. But in terms of your long-term supplementation, you always want to be taking that with vitamin K.
Okay, good to know. That's great. So you call it PCOS, I call it PCOS, but polycystic ovarian syndrome. Can we talk about that now? Yeah. Again, I don't really know very much about it apart from I've had clients who've really struggled with it in the past and I've just obviously referred out, but they really struggle. Heavy, heavy periods, extremely horrid PMS and cramping and stuff. So can you tell us what that is all about and things that people can do to help sort of alleviate some of the symptomatic side of that?
Yeah, and it's a condition that will really change when we go through, you know, perimenopause too. So PCOS is it's a difficult name because not every woman with this condition has classic polycystic ovaries. So that name comes from doing an ultrasound and looking to see that there's multiple sort of immature and faulty follicles, and they come in a little string, and that was the diagnosis initially for PCOS. So what this condition can be is you can have those visible multiple cysts on your ovary. You often have high androgens, whether they're coming from your ovary or your adrenal gland. So that can be testosterone or DHEA or something like one of those other androgens. And it is helpful to know which one because it can give you a better indication of how to treat it. And there's also often anovulation. So for some reason, you're not ovulating very well. So that's sort of how you get diagnosed. At a root cause from that or below that is usually inflammation and some insulin resistance. And this manifests itself in, like you said, most women have an irregular period, so a longer cycle. Some women don't ovulate or have a period at all. Some women have a regular period. And so PCOS can be a little bit confusing because while you may have a diagnosis, you may not be totally sure how to best treat it because it doesn't look like your girlfriend's PCOS. So I'm someone who, I have PCOS, unless I'm really super stressed, I've always had a pretty regular cycle. When I get stressed, it would sort of disappear. I've always struggled with the elevated androgens and the breakouts. I've managed to not have a lot of hair growth or hair loss, but those can be symptoms of PCOS as well. So as a root cause, inflammation is a biggie. We are sort of genetically hardwired to be more sensitive to inflammation and to get inflamed easier. So again, going back to everything I said earlier, knowing what foods cause you inflammation, having a healthy gut, rest, recovery, managing stress, all those things become really important. When it comes to insulin resistance, If you just have insulin resistance, then like a lower carb diet, that's going to be helpful as far as managing that. What I always want to remind women with PCOS is you may have PCOS, but you also have a thyroid, you also have an adrenal gland, you also have a gut. Just because you have an issue with PCOS and you don't ovulate properly, so therefore you're low progesterone, doesn't mean that you don't also have a thyroid problem or that you don't also have to tend to maybe a low cortisol issue. So in the book and in my work, the way that I always teach women to take care of themselves is to follow what I call the hormone hierarchy. So you want to always address your more sensitive, more delicate hormone issues first. So anything, if you're dealing with low cortisol or low thyroid, any advice for those hormones needs to be heeded first. Next on the list is high cortisol, then insulin resistance, then estrogen and progesterone. And so for a woman with PCOS, this gets really tricky. So like, let's take me when I was in school or right after I had a baby, I still had insulin resistance. So I need to exercise and I need to watch my carbs and my sugar. But now I was dealing with a lot of low cortisol, right? Because I'm just not getting enough sleep. I had a lot of stress going on. And so what used to work for me was just being really low carb, and I worked out a lot and everything was fine. But during those times, that didn't work at all because I had, you know, to really honor the fact that I probably needed a little more carbohydrates spread throughout the day. I couldn't overdo it, but I also couldn't not do any of it because I had to tend to that low cortisol issue. And I still needed some exercise, but I couldn't do a lot of metabolic training during that time, walking, heavier lifting, focusing on rest and recovery. So we want to, whether you have PCOS or anything else, again, like honoring those hormones in that order is the way to do it. So when a woman starts going through perimenopause, you know, inflammation can get worse when we start losing some of our female hormone balance. We already tend to be low progesterone if we're not ovulating well. So some of the fallout from that, we become very stress sensitive. So we're stress sensitive in general going through perimenopause, but women with PCOS are going to lose their progesterone probably even quicker. Some of that estrogen dominance can come up even quicker. And thyroid gets caught in the mix. There are some experts that say that there is a thyroid type of PCOS. In my opinion, that is, you can look at an ovary and think it has PCOS, but you give it thyroid hormone and it goes back to normal. To me, that's not true PCOS. That's just a consequence of hypothyroidism, that once the thyroid is fixed, it's going to resolve.
And you said the cascading nature of everything, because it's all, basically you're saying it's all integrated, right? Not one thing just doesn't stand alone. It's all connected.
Yeah. And I feel like what's unfortunate for the women with PCOS is, you know, they're always told like, well, you just need to exercise a bunch and you need to cut your carbs. But if you've got a woman who's also got low cortisol and PCOS, that's not going to work for her. Because again, she wants to honor those things probably first. Get those adrenals, you know, healed, and then be able to, you know, deal more with some of the insulin resistance. And the reason, you know, I came up with that hierarchy, and one of the reasons Sarah and I wrote the book the way that we did is, you know, most women don't have one hormone issue. Like, look at a woman going through perimenopause. She's probably got a borderline thyroid tending towards some sort of HPA axis and low cortisol issue. And she's losing her female hormones, which are causing her to be more stress sensitive and more insulin resistant. So it's like, that is all the hormones right there, right? That's all the stuff that we need to think about. And so it can be so hard when advice is so myopic, right? It's like, well, if you've got insulin resistance, do all the Metcon, don't eat carbohydrate, try keto. And then the advice for your low thyroid is, well, don't do any exercise, just rest and maybe a little bit of yoga. And you need to eat lots of carbs. You need to eat 6 times a day, which is, you know, very, very conflicting. And again, many women have both of those issues.
Right. Yeah. So it's knowing exactly where to sort of like start on this. And again, like you said, I love the fact that you keep saying it's all connected, because the problem it is, and things change as well. And especially through perimenopause, you know, you're going to go through ebbs and flows of different symptoms, and it's never going to be static, is it? It's the continuing journey of perimenopause. But with this in the mix, I can't even imagine. Hi guys, Amanda here. I'm just jumping in to ask you a quick favor. If you are enjoying my podcast, then I'd love you to leave me a review on either iTunes or Google Play. It helps me get in front of new listeners so I can keep making great content for you. And in return, I'd like to send you my Abs on Fire 12-week core focused workout plan. All you need to do after you've done your review is simply email me at amanda@fitandchips.com and I'll send you the program straight away. Thanks, guys, for all your support. And now back to the show. You did speak before about getting a glucometer. Can we just talk a little bit about that? Because I actually ran out and got one.
Oh, yeah.
And I walked out the shop and I pricked my finger straight away because I was obsessed and I had mine was fine. But it was very exciting. I mean, I love numbers and things and stats. But can you just talk a little bit about that and how it can help?
Yeah, and this is a great tool for PCOS or perimenopause or anyone just trying to figure out, like, you know, I think the conversation in the fitness and nutrition world is like, do what works for you. And most women are like, I would do that if I had any clue what actually works for me, right? My hormones are sending me mixed signals. I don't know what works. Nothing's working right now. So yeah, we want to do what works for us. But part of the, you know, the biggest step in that is like, well, what the heck is that? And some women can tell from their symptoms. So you know, symptoms that I use as far as insulin and cortisol go are, appetite, cravings, energy, sleep. So it spells ACEs. So appetite, cravings, energy, sleep after meals. Well, not sleep. Let's just talk about appetite, cravings, energy. After you eat, that's going to be indicative of insulin issues. If you're getting low energy, sleepy, craving sugar, craving coffee after you eat, it could be inflammation, like you may have eaten something that you're sensitive to, or you could have overshot your carb tolerance. If you're getting, you know, increased appetite, increased cravings, or low energy between meals, that's more your cortisol talking. If you know, can't fall asleep or stay asleep, that could be mostly cortisol issues. But so that little acronym for a lot of women, I have them sort of walk through finding their carb tolerance. So like this amount and this type of carb, what happens, and then change it and see what happens. And walking through what type of carbohydrate, what amount, and at which meals, just by using that ACEs feedback, you can get a lot of information about what your blood sugar is doing. There we go. I think I'm through that now. But for some women, either like you, they just love numbers and they would rather, you know, just have a number to look at, or they are not really sure. Like they're paying attention to those signals, but it's just not clear.
The answer is still not there for them yet.
Yeah. And a glucometer is a great tool. So, you know, we tend to think of that as just being for people with diabetes or insulin resistance, but it's a great tool. And a lot of times women will notice like, you know, my blood sugar is really low in the morning, and that's probably why I don't want to eat anything, and I definitely don't want to eat protein. Or they might notice that it's going up too high after they shake their branch chains, right? So you want to get a glucometer if you are somebody, again, who's unclear about what their hormones are telling them, or you just like a little bit more, you know, objective data. They're not terribly expensive. I usually use the One Touch Ultra, but there are a number of them out there. The strips are where they get you as far as the expense, but most women find if they just get one vial of strips and do this experiment, they get really in tune with what it is and they're not going to be sticking themselves.
You don't need to continue to do it. It literally is like it's a self-experiment. Yeah, I agree. And they're about $20, $30, right? They're not.
Yeah. And what you were saying before, you know, women's hormones are very much a moving target. They change throughout the month. They certainly change throughout the decades. They change when we go through pregnancy and perimenopause and all of those things. So it is important to, you know, be able to roll with that, right? And figure out like, okay, well, this is what I was doing and it worked great. And now that I'm a year into perimenopause, I need to rethink that. And, or maybe you just went through a really stressful event or you just tripped a thyroid issue. And so now we just have to continually be tuning in, whether to those hormone symptoms, I call it the hormone talk, or to your glucometer. So when you get the glucometer, you want to first start by taking it in the morning, and then you want to take it at the start of a meal, and then 1 hour and 2 hours afterwards. So it is going to feel like you're sticking yourself all day, but that's the best way to get a read on what it's actually looking like throughout the day. And I have I walk through how to do this in the book, but there's also an article on my website. Just type in glucometer at betterbydrbrooke.com, and it'll walk you through exactly how to do that experiment.
Yeah, that's great. And then is there any, with regard to the PCOS, is there any supplements that you can recommend for women to take?
Yeah, so when it comes to the insulin resistance piece of it, you want to be sure that you've got like a good suite of B vitamins. Again, nutrients, minerals like chromium and vanadium can be helpful. Alpha lipoic acid is another great one. So I have a product in my line called Balanced and Beautiful, and that is a PCOS-based multi. So if you have any issues with insulin, there's also a free quiz on my website, so you could take the insulin resistance quiz and see if any of those things come up for you. But that multi will cover a lot of things. And I find if women do that, and the diet, that usually gets them most of the way. Fish oils can be really important, a couple grams a day, whether you're eating them or supplementing with them. And then if you're having additional blood sugar issues, like those things aren't quite enough, the nutrient berberine, or the herb berberine, 200 to 500 milligrams with a meal has been shown to be as effective as the drug metformin for some women. So that's a really powerful thing to use. So if you're still feeling like your blood sugar is running too high, berberine's available from a wide variety of people. I have a product in my line. I also use Vital Nutrients, has a 200 and a 500 milligram capsule. You can find that anywhere. And that's usually, you know, we still want to be doing the exercise and the inflammation and all those things too, but that can be really helpful to, in terms of lowering your blood sugar, because sometimes we do need help. This is a mechanism in us that doesn't work very well. Inositol is another nutrient that can work. If you're using the mild form of inositol, it's usually 1 to 2 grams. That also boosts serotonin. So some women find that that helps with a couple of female hormone things, and also with sleep and anxiety. And if you're having, if you're having a lot of fallout from the androgen, so your testosterone or DHEA, as far as PCOS goes, and you're getting hair loss, particularly at the front, hair growth where you don't want it, or breakouts, you can use things like saw palmetto, nettles, and again, that 30 milligrams of zinc. Again, I have a product in my line called Clear and Normalize that has all those things in it, but you can find those other places as well.
Okay, that's great. Okay, as time ticks on, Brooke, we're running out of a little bit of time, but we need to talk about wine, right?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. So, you know, I know you're in the group and you see us talking about it. And one of the things I noticed personally is I just can't tolerate alcohol anymore. And it was I wasn't a massive drinker, but it literally was my only vice, apart from swearing, right? But that's my hand. You know,
swear all the way through menopause.
And you have to, I think, to make it sound. But I just stopped being able to tolerate specifically wine. The red wine triggered chronic migraines that was because of my low estrogen. And so that I just don't drink red wine anymore. And the white wine is like drinking pure acid. But even afterwards, the recovery, it's shocking. And I know other women feel like this as well. And yet we need it. So come on.
We enjoy it.
What's going on,
Brooke? Yeah, so a couple things. I mean, one thing we want to think about is just kind of as we go through life, and depending on how much gunk is in our environment, so we do have a lot of things we can't escape, right? There's pollution and our water's not that great and all those sorts of things. But cleaning up as much as we can in our home environments with plastics and the fragrances and the parabens and the preservatives and all that kind of stuff and the pesticides that comes in on our food, the more we can clean up in our home and our personal care, and again, ditching plastic as much as we can, will decrease the burden on our liver. So there is a bit of an accumulation just as we get older. And, you know, in time, a lot of our enzymes are just not running as fast as they need to. So that's a really simple way to just kind of boost your metabolism. I mean, it's commonly called detox, but I always call it biotransformation, because I think detox has become this like green smoothie weird thing that people think is... Yeah. Pokey.
But, well, it's like Dr. Snyder, who is a colleague of your friend of yours, will say you can't green smoothie your way out of chronic stress. People just, right. The green smoothie is the answer. And it's
when I always say it's kale, I'm like, kale doesn't cure stress. You can eat all the kale you want, but you know, you're yeah. still gonna have to like deal with the really long to-do list. But so one thing to think about is, you know, just basic liver support, which is cleaning up your environment. There's, of course, nutrients you can take to kind of like help your liver along. Now, as you start to go through hormone fluctuations, it is going to be a bigger burden on your liver in some ways, because you have more disruption of some of the estrogen metabolism. If you have an unhealthy gut, that's going to put the burden on your detoxification. So again, going back to those things, just kind of as a baseline, you can definitely take nutrients like N-acetylcysteine and milk thistle, just kind of like nourish your liver a little bit and give it a little bit more support. However, there's just some unique things that happen when it comes to, you know, estrogen and metabolism of some of the things that come in wine. So hard alcohol is sort of a little bit different, but with wine, there are what are called biogenic amines. So they're these sort of like active kind of upper type things that are in wine, and it's part of the fermentation process. There's also a lot more garbage in American-made wines. So there's more pesticides, there's more pollutants, there's more chemicals, there's more gunk. So one of the first things to do is switch from American wines to European or Australian wines, especially European wines. So French, Spanish, Italian are going to overall be better. They just don't have as much contamination in their farming practices. So some
Can I just ask a quick question on that? And this might, you might just shoot me down because it might be false, but do some of the American wines also have added colors and sugars to make them more palatable and to have longer shelf life?
They definitely do. Yeah. We had on our podcast, Todd from Dry Farm Wines. If you guys don't know about Dry Farm Wines, it's sort of like a curating service. They basically source and curate a collection of wines. They're low sugar, they're low histamine, low biogenic amines, and they're, you know, tested for all of like the pesticides, et cetera. And so they basically will send them to your house. You know, if you want someone to deliver you wine at home, who doesn't, right? But if you want someone to deliver you wine that's going to be not, it's more keto friendly, it's more environmentally friendly. So those things are available, but all of their wines are from Europe. They are all lower sugar. So if you can choose a lower sugar, lower contaminant wine, so definitely sticking with the European varieties, that's going to get you part of the way. Now, those biogenic amines, there's going to be less of them in a less contaminated wine, but they're still there. It's just part of the fermentation, right? We're going to have histamine and tyramine and things like that. Those can have a little bit of a stimulating property in their own right. So what a lot of women will notice is they fall asleep okay after drinking wine, but then they wake up in the middle of the night and they're just wide awake, right?
Yeah. Okay. Why?
Yeah. So that there's an enzyme called MAO, and it is trying to process all of those amines, and it gets a little bit bogged down. So, you know, again, the less gunk your whole system has to go through, the sort of better overall you will be. That enzyme can be bolstered a little bit by riboflavin, vitamin B2. So this is found in foods like mushrooms, spinach, almonds. Lamb, I think is another one. You could Google that, foods high in riboflavin. So that can be helpful, just eating more of those foods. But you can also take like 100 milligrams of riboflavin one or two times a day, and that may boost that enzyme a little bit. Magnesium can be helpful here too. So that can be something that helps you just process it a little bit better. And it is just kind of an unfortunate consequence. And some of us know our genes, like our genes, we've done 23andMe. So I have a really sluggish MAO. So this was something that was really a problem for me, even at a young age. I would get that thing where I would wake up after having wine. So doing lower sugars, doing, you know, I don't eat a lot of other foods with those things in it. If you guys have followed me at all, you know, I dealt with a histamine intolerance. So I don't eat a lot of foods that are high in histamine. I save it for wine.
And I've noticed my histamine tolerance has changed in menopause as well. And a lot of women have like their immune response to things and also their histamine response. And I think that that's something to take into take into account as well. Because I know a lot of us have had this conversation, and the way that wine acts in our body is completely change. And also it doesn't happen with the, what you call it, hard liquor, but like the, like whiskeys and gins. Why is that then? Is it the fermentation? Is it because they're distilled?
And again, it's like that, those biogenic amines like tyramines and histamines, there's gonna be histamine in like a barrel aged something, but it's, the process is not quite the same. It tends to be worse in wine.
So what's the answer? I mean, you haven't really said, I'm not going to take a B2 100 micrograms with my wine, am I? I mean, or do I eat almonds with it? Or will it change? Will it come back? We need to know.
I think that, you know, making sure, again, you're taking a B complex in general or adding some more riboflavin, that will speed that enzyme along. And then making sure, again, your wine doesn't have as much, you know, sugar and those other things. So, and that switch does seem to help a lot of women, just switching to, you know, better quality wine and from Europe and not from America. And then the B2 thing can help. As far as histamine goes, so estrogen will make your histamine issues worse. And so what happens in perimenopause is, again, we have those ups and downs, right? You have like those fluctuations in estrogen. That part may actually get better after menopause. Right.
Okay. Oh, oh, I saw a glimmer of light then.
Yeah. But again, you can't go wrong going back to making sure your gut's healthy and making sure your liver has like a little bit of support, and then steering clear of like the extra sugar. And that helps. Sometimes it's just a no-go during perimenopause. You're going to have some fallout, but those things can help.
Good. Good. That's really good to know. That's awesome.
I wish I had like the magic, you know, wine pill. I really do.
Oh, don't stop working on that. I mean, honestly.
I'm on it. That and having more than 24 hours in a day are my projects.
Listen, thank you so much for coming on. That was a really great show. It was a bit longer than usual. I wanted it to be because I wanted women to get all of this information. Your book, let's quickly talk about the book before we finish up. The book is called Hangry. It was going to be called Hangry Bitches. Am I right? Was that?
Yeah. So all the Hangry Bitches stuff is still on the inside. We just ended up taking it off the cover.
That's fine. I'm a hangry bitch, and I think most of us are. So we totally relate to that. That's due for launch on the 4th of June. You can pre-order it now on Kindle or on Amazon for the hardback. But if you do that, you can get these bonus materials. How do they do that? Is that via your website?
So that will be up on sarahanddrbrooke.com. And so if you've pre-ordered the book, so again, the book comes out June 4th. And if you can pre-order anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, anywhere you get online books. And then you'll just enter your invoice number on sarahanddrbrooke.com on the Hangry Book page. And then you can get, I did a webinar on menopause, one on PCOS, one on thyroid. So those are all free bonuses. Sarah did some great mobility work, our dynamic warm-up, and some great cooking tips. If you don't know Sarah, she's a 5-time best-selling cookbook author. She did all the recipes in the, we collaborated on the strength training. And then I did the hormone piece. Sarah did a lot of the mindset work. And so our book is really covers you from what I would say is mindset to muscles to meals. We've got kind of a full meal deal. And again, with any book, it's going to have a template of strength training, a template of food, a template of habits and mindset tools. But the gem, I think the real value in this book is it's going to give you that template, but then it's going to teach you how to make it work for you. Like what, according to your unique hormone issues, for some of you guys, of course, that's, you know, the low progesterone and the low cortisol and the insulin resistance and those things that happen in perimenopause. It's going to take that template and then help you know, how do I adjust this to work better for me?
Right. That's perfect. Well, listen, good luck with everything. Good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on the show for the second time.
I'll have to come on another time and record that too. And we'll, you know.
That's great. But thank you again. That was really great information. And thank you everybody for listening. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the show. For more information on my services, head over to my website at fitandchips.com. That's like fish and chips, FITNCHIPS.com. Or you can head over to my Fit and Chips Facebook page too. If you leave me a comment or if you contact me, I promise I'll do my best to respond to all of your questions. The views and advice expressed by myself in this show are not a substitute for conventional medical service. No information here should be interpreted as a medical diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of any disease. If in any doubt, always go straight to your doctor. Take care. Love you. Bye.